Maybe just.
Hi.
So we're happy to have Alexa Kataya today, who will talk about something to do with entanglement. I've forgotten the title. Sorry.
Short-range entangled quantum states. I'm interested in the topological classification of quantum states right now. It's kind of a math topic, but my background is condensed matter physics. So let me give a short introduction about this problem. It really comes from condensed matter physics. And condensed matter physicists, at least some of them, are interested in solid state systems at zero temperature. And zero temperature is interesting because temperature usually destroys subtle quantum effects. And one really needs to go to very low temperature to observe them. Now, different systems are sensitive to temperature in different ways, and there is a class of systems with an energy gap in the spectrum, which means that there is a ground state and the next state is high up in energy by some constant number that is independent of the system size. For example, aluminum is superconducting at low temperature. It has a gap of about 3 Kelvin, and if experimentalists work with aluminum at low temperature, like 20 millikelvin, then a reasonably sized piece of aluminum will have no excitations at all, no Bogoliubov quasi-particles, to be specific. And this means it's practically at zero temperature. And the system is in the ground state. So I'm interested in studying quantum states of a large system, basically, and what kind of properties and what kind of states will be clear later. So a quantum system, if we don't care about details at all, then a quantum system is just a finite dimensional, I prefer finite dimensional Hilbert space. And say H and quantum state is just a vector in that space up to a factor. So we're talking about the projective structure. Psi is equivalent to C times psi, where C is a non-zero number. But that's too little structure, and let's consider something more realistic. Say a metal or an insulator, any solid state system consists of atoms, and electrons move between those atoms. Now, electrons can move continuously, but for this talk, let me make this approximation. There are atoms, and each atom has its own Hilbert space, and electrons can hop. So we have this arrangement. We have some set of atoms, and I'm now defining a quantum system which has some geometric properties. Quantum system on space Y, and Y can be the n-dimensional space, like the three-dimensional or two-dimensional, or it can be a disk in that space. It's a finite system, or it can be actually a subset of Rn with sufficiently nice properties, like a retractable neighborhood. But let me just consider these two cases, Rn and Dn. And what is the quantum system? We have a set of atoms or sites A, and each atom is represented by a Hilbert space H sub J. And we have a map so each atom is put in a certain position in that space Y, and that is a quantum system. Now this H sub J, if we consider systems where electrons don't hop, just interact between different atoms, that's fine. If they can jump from atom to atom, then we must say that each H sub J is a Z2 graded Hilbert space, because we should distinguish between an even number of electrons and an odd number of electrons on each side. Electrons are fermions, and for fermions that's important. And I'll explain fermions later on. This is a geometric quantum system, and the problem is to define a nice quantum state. Part of the problem is a definition of a nice quantum state. And we want it to have some nice mathematical properties too. So let me explain what we're looking for from the physical perspective, one kind of phenomena. Let me talk about two-dimensional systems, in particular integer quantum Hall systems and fractional quantum Hall systems. An integer quantum Hall system has quantized Hall conductivity in two dimensions. It quantized to very high precision at low temperature. And it also has this peculiar property that in the bulk, the system is gapped. But on the boundary, there are gapless modes. The smallest energy of an excitation created in the bulk is constant, say 10 Kelvin or in that range. But the energy at the edge can be arbitrarily small. It depends on the system size. In a large system, it can be arbitrarily small. This is one interesting system. Another interesting system is fractional quantum Hall effect, where in the bulk there are also anions. These are special particles with non-trivial Braden properties. And Braden properties of particles in two dimensions are described by something called a unitary modular tensor category. That is interesting. It's an interesting mathematical object, but I want to focus on this kind of system when we don't have anions, because anions are rather complicated, and more importantly, we don't know how to generalize them to high dimensions. Even in two dimensions, there are problems with making a good definition of a quantum state that would be general enough, because although a fractional quantum Hall system is locally correlated, it has long-range entanglement, which means the following. If we know the reduced density matrices for small disks, then It may not be possible to uniquely reconstruct the reduced density matrix of the whole system. On a disk, it's possible, but if it's an annulus geometry, if there is a hole inside, if we know the reduced density matrices for all these disks covering that annulus, then we cannot reconstruct it on the annulus. That is a complication I want to avoid. So let's consider systems like that. A particular big class of systems one can solve completely at the moment are so-called free-Fermion systems. I'll explain the corresponding formalism and give the answer, how to define and how to classify those systems. And I'll try to generalize that formalism and the answer, but here there is an open problem, so we need to work more. Let me talk about fermions in general. A fermionic system is described by a Z2 graded Hilbert space. H is H0 plus upper indices. This is the space of states with an even number of fermions, and that is for the odd number of fermions. And when we consider the tensor product of such spaces, and we should consider the tensor product because we have multiple atoms, we should multiply all those spaces. The tensor product is defined in the usual way, except that when we define the swap operation, it's like A B A. Then we should use a modified swap. Graded swap, which is sum over alpha beta minus 1 alpha beta times the usual swap between A sub alpha . So when we swap two subsystems with an odd number of fermions, there is a minus sign. Now, let's discuss free fermions. A free fermion system has a Hilbert space with an additional structure. It's called the Fock space corresponding to a much smaller space. If we have some space L, which is C to the M, then we can define the Fock space of L like sum over this is the anti-symmetric power, and in physics it's usually done in coordinates. So one introduces a special state zero, or the vacuum state corresponding to k equal to zero, and one also introduces a basis in the space L. And for each basis vector, we define a symbol called the creation operator, A sub 1 dagger through A sub M dagger. So for each basis vector, we have this symbol. A basis in the Fox space will be given by A sub 1 dagger to the N sub 1. This is the occupation number of the first state product. I guess I should... This will be a basis of the Fox space. And this apparatus have the usual commutation relation. They form a Grassmann algebra. And there are also adjoint apparatus without a dagger. And for the adjoint apparatus, the commutation relation is this. So we have a set of apparatus acting in the Fox space, and you can see that if this one has dimension m, then the Fox space have has dimension 2 to the m. So this is the Hilbert space. Let's define a free fermion state in that space, and that's. I'll not use geometry at the moment. I'll introduce it later.
So, you want only one dagger in that equation?
Oh, yeah. In that equation, we need the dagger. Yeah, thank you. So, let's take X to be an operator on L on the small space. The small space is the space of single fermion state. Single electron states. And we assume that it's self-adjoint and squares to 1, so its eigenvalues are plus and minus 1. And we consider subspace, it's an eigenspace corresponding to the eigenvalue minus 1. And it says a subspace in the space of single electron states. Let's fill all those states with electrons, which means that we pick a basis in M, and this basis will again be interpreted in terms of apparatus. It's B1 through B little m. This little m is the dimension of big M. This will be a basis of M, and we define psi of X, and we can we could put M to be B1 so we start with the vacuum and put electrons in those states, and these guys are linear combinations of the A's. So this way we have to specify a sufficiently small amount of information, just m squared numbers. M is the dimension of that space. And we get a vector in the exponentially big space. This is a free fermion state. It's a non-superconducting state. For superconducting states, one needs some generalization. In physics, such states occur as ground states of quadratic Hamiltonians. And in general, quantum states usually occur as ground states of some Hamiltonians. We want to define this relation, and let's just do it. This x has eigenvalues plus or minus 1. But let's consider H, which will have exactly the same eigenspaces, the same eigenvectors as x, but different eigenvalues. So there will be some H, some non-degenerate. And we can write the Hamiltonian H hat in this form. It will be sum over J and K, the matrix elements of this operator. Put heads here. So we just have a matrix of m squared elements, and we define an operator acting in the exponentially big space, in the Fock space. The ground state of this Hamiltonian will be of that form, where x is the sign of H. What is this sine function? I'm using the operator calculus on the Hermitian operators. So if H has eigenvectors psi 1 through I'll omit these brackets, psi 1 through psi m. These are the eigenvectors, and the corresponding eigenvalues will be epsilon 1 through epsilon m. Since it's non-degenerate, all the eigenvalues are non-zero, and we replace all negative eigenvalues by minus 1 and all positive by plus 1. And we keep the eigenvectors. This way we define x, and its eigenspace for the eigenvalue of minus 1 corresponds to the eigenvectors with negative energies. So we're filling all negative energy states with electrons. Now, in this construction, we see that there is some redundancy in H because we need to use this x, which is the sine of H. And this redundancy occurs in physics, and it's also convenient for many purposes. Let me explain why this redundancy won't matter for my talk, for the program I'm going to define. I haven't introduced geometry yet, but we can still talk about the topology of quantum states and the topology of non-degenerate Hamiltonians. If we fix M, then we can define the topological space of free fermion states. Let me use this symbol F. Now, this space is not connected because there will be different connected components. We can have different M, different spaces, capital M of different dimensions. And actually, it's the union of connected components. And when we fix the dimension, the topological space of this guy is U capital M divided by U little m plus U this is the topological space of free fermion states. And we can define a topological space of non-degenerate Hamiltonians in a similar way. Yeah, of course, each non-degenerate Hamiltonian gives some free fermion state. So for each matrix, we can define the negative eigenspace. This map is a vibration, and the fiber is actually contractible. So if we are going to do some homotopy theory, then we can use either space for our purposes. It doesn't matter which one we use. Yeah?
I think there's something confusing about your notation, because over on that board you used little m for the dimension of big M. And here you mean something different.
No.
Oh, sorry, I used two capital M. One is this one straight, is and then the other is curly.
Oh, okay. Capital M is the dimension of L.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought was confusing notation.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we could change it, yeah.
Okay.
So, when we work with non-degenerate Hamiltonians, it's a softer system. And if we want to interpolate between two Hamiltonians, it's easy to do. Since interpolation is very convenient, I prefer to work with this soft definition. This is the definition without taking geometry into account. How do we introduce geometry? Well, a quantum system is just a set of atoms. Each atom is actually a space, a finite dimensional Hilbert space, and it has a certain position in the physical space. So everything is going on in the physical space, and in this picture the physical space is just R. We want to define a nice quantum state that is at the same time a free fermion state, so we'll define a nice matrix H. Will mean that H has an energy gap and it's local. So there are two conditions. One, H is L, little l, local, which means that H JK vanishes if the distance between the corresponding atoms. In Rn, in R, in this case, is greater than L. And condition 2, H is gapped. And that condition requires some work. The naive version is this. The spectrum of H is contained in two intervals from some number minus lambda to minus delta union delta and lambda. And it's important that it's bounded away from zero. So it starts at delta or at negative delta. But yeah, this is the definition of an energy gap.
Sorry, let's see. Yeah. That's different from the Hamiltonian gap, right? I thought it's
about
the H hat is gapped.
H hat is also gapped. This guarantees.
It's a consequence of this. Then.
Yeah, it's a consequence of that. So the gap of H hat will be 2 delta. Because the ground state will have all those eigenvalues filled. If we want to make an excited state, we have to move an electron from this range to that range, and that will cost energy 2 delta. But this definition is a bit tricky. As written, it can only be used in an infinite system like R. Because if we introduce boundary, in interesting examples, the boundary is gapless. So this definition cannot be used. And we'll have to deal with it, but let me give an interesting example right away. Let's just consider an infinite chain of atoms. And let me introduce an additional constraint on the Hamiltonian. There'll be two sorts of atoms. There'll be white atoms and black atoms. And the electrons are not allowed to hop between atoms of the same color. They can only hop between white and black. So this is the picture, and they can hop this way or that way, but they cannot hop this way. Then the Hamiltonian matrix has this form, and A does not have to be Hermitian. A is basically any invertible matrix, or A is a matrix with some gap constraint, meaning that let me consider a particular operator A that does this. A j equals j plus 1. So in this case, the electrons hop to the right by one unit. This matrix is non-trivial. This is a shift matrix, and to see that it is non-trivial, we can cut it. We can consider it not on an infinite line, but on a half-infinite. This truncated version of A will have non-trivial index. It will have a non-trivial kernel, but a trivial kernel. If it shifts the other way, it will be the other way around. We see that when we consider systems with some geometric constraint like that, then we get new invariants. So, to go further, we need a better definition, because it's very awkward to use a definition that only works in infinite systems. But in this problem, all information is local, and the conditions should also be local. So we need some notion of a local gap. This can be achieved in the following way. Let's rewrite that condition on the right in terms of the spectrum of H squared. H squared his eigenvalues between lambda squared and delta squared. And since we started with a problem where instead of h we had x with eigenvalues exactly plus or minus 1, then delta and lambda are both equal to 1, and this interval is actually a point. We may consider something intermediate. It's not arbitrary delta and arbitrary lambda, but delta and lambda are close to 1. So we may consider this constraint. 1 minus delta is smaller than h squared is smaller than 1 plus delta. And let's try to make a local version of that. A local version of this will be let me use this notation, h squared minus 1 id, and this will be b. This condition without these two projectors says that, oh sorry, it's too confusing, I have jumped ahead, let me go back. So this condition can be written as h squared is smaller than delta with respect to the operating norm. Now, let's introduce disks of a certain radius r, and for each disk we define a projector onto sides that belong to that disk, onto the atoms. And we replace this condition with that one. And we impose such a condition for every disk. I claim that this is a reasonable local version of that global gap notion. And to support that, I'll formulate a lemma. This lemma says that given this local condition, if it really holds in every disk, it implies the global one. So the lemma is this. Let an operator B be L local, and H squared minus 1 is actually 2 L local, but we can just change this parameter. We also suppose that pi d b pi d norm is smaller than delta for all disks d of radius r such that d has non-trivial intersection with the support of b. Then the norm of b itself is smaller than delta times this big O of L squared over R squared. So if we really have this condition fulfilled for all disks, then we can infer the global condition. Now, if we replace B with H squared minus 1, then this condition will not be fulfilled for all disks. Suppose this original Hamiltonian H is defined not on an infinite line, but on some interval.
Well, is L the length of the system or something?
This?
O or L local, sorry.
So the Hamiltonian H is defined on a finite interval when we construct H squared minus 1 and check that condition for H squared, this condition for H squared minus 1. It will be true in the bulk, but it won't be true for disks near the ends. And therefore, we cannot use this lemma directly, but it's a good motivation for the definition.
This is still in the context of free fermion systems?
Yeah, this is a free fermion.
I mean, this seems like a pretty special property for a free fermion system. Do you have examples that satisfy this?
For free fermion system?
That the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian seem like they're clustering at plus and minus 1. I mean, that's a...
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. We can transform an arbitrary Hamiltonian, an arbitrary gap Hamiltonian, to that Hamiltonian in the following fashion. If we have some Hamiltonian H where all the is kind of outside this definition, but we may say that morally the spectrum in the bulk is in that range. What do we do to satisfy this definition? We take some function of H. If we take the sine function, then we get eigenvalues exactly plus and minus 1. If we take some polynomial that approximates the sine function, we will satisfy this condition. Mm. Now, we have a good definition of a local free fermion system. Let me give the answer. we want to specify the geometry and say our geometry will be a disk Dn in dimension n, and there will be some parameters L and delta, and those parameters can be taken as constants, meaning that they are only functions of the dimension. This disk Dn is of radius 1, and the little l and delta are certain constants, and that already makes a good definition if we don't put any restriction on the number of atoms or on the dimensions of the Hilbert spaces. We can classify quantum states in that disk and define the space F sub n. Let me use this notation, U1, meaning that I'll also put this quantification free. So we consider free fermion systems with U1 symmetry, meaning that the number of particles is conserved. And the Hamiltonian, I have written this sum of A degree A preserves the number of particles. If it doesn't preserve the number of particles, then there will be terms like A times A or A degree times A degree. So when the number of particles is conserved, then Fn free is homotopy equivalent to this thing. It's BO cross Z, BU cross Z if n is even. And U if n is odd. This is the infinite unitary group, and that is the classifying space for the infinite unitary group. And of course, this answer should agree with the similar answer for n equals 0. For n equals 0, we have the following thing. We have F0 sum over little m u of
Yeah, I've been struggling to, I think this is related to Joe's question. I've been struggling to understand the significance of working in this intermediate world between completely flattened and not flattened spectrum. So you've chosen to almost flatten the spectrum, but not quite.
Right.
That's a new idea to me. Why?
Why are you doing that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I understand why you flatten the spectrum to remove the contractible part.
Yeah.
And I understand why you leave the Hamiltonian alone and do nothing. Because that's Occam's razor. But why do you almost flatten the spectrum?
Right. The key construction in this subject is this. We have a family of Hamiltonians. Let's consider this family is running up, and this up is the parameter of time, adiabatic time. The horizontal direction is space. So at each time slice, we have a new Hamiltonian. And now we want to construct a diagonal Hamiltonian. At this point in space, we take a snapshot at t equals 0. at this point we take a snapshot at t equals to 1/2. And here we take a snapshot at t equals 1. And we want to glue all those snapshots. If we allow just a little bit of softness, this will be possible. So we have this thing, but that's assuming that the dimension M is fixed. Now we can consider a limit when M, capital M, goes to infinity. And it's a bit tricky what to do with this little m. So let me say a few more words about these spaces. These are actually spaces with base points. And to take the limit of capital M going to infinity, we need to define a base point. And basically, we consider spaces L, L sub j, with subspaces M sub j, and both can grow, meaning that we increase the total number of states available for the electrons, and we also use some subspace M sub j for kind of the reference state. For example, in an atom, usually the inner shells are filled with electrons. The outer shells are empty, and only one shell is active. It can take electrons in and out. So we allow arbitrary subspaces M sub j for the inner shells that are normally filled, or can take a few electrons out, but not all. And we consider a directed system of such objects. So we have M1, L1, and this grows M2, L2, and so on. And those spaces M with index 0 will form a base point eventually. So as the dimension, the total dimension of the space grows, this dimension of normally full states or subspaces also grows. And when taking the limit, we must consider this difference, M minus the dimension of that space. And if we do that, then in the limit, this difference will gives us this, and that thing will give us that. So
union again is going to direct sum.
Oh yeah. It's not the direct sum. It's the union. Yeah. Now, let me skip the proof of that. It's a non-trivial result. Let me discuss some generalizations to interacting systems. What do we want to understand about interacting systems, and what kind of systems do we hope to understand? This will be systems with only short-range entanglement, where the knowledge of reduced density matrices allows us to reconstruct the whole state. It's hard to define a minimal condition like that. I'll just define a sufficient condition. This sufficient condition will allow this kind of local reconstruction. And the sufficient condition is based on the following idea. If we have a quantum system, say, with free fermions, a quantum Hall layer with occupation number nu equals 1, or topological invariant equal to 1, there is an integer topological invariant. And there is another layer with nu equals minus 1. When we stack these two layers, we can continuously deform the system to a trivial system. There is a kind of constellation. And mathematically, it's expressed by a homotopy between this matrix and that matrix in the space of non-degenerate Hermitian matrices. And we can define some matrix B of T, which is this matrix times cosine pi t over 2, t goes from 0 to 1, plus this matrix and if we say this is x, actually altogether, this is y. When we calculate the spectrum of x plus y, let's take x plus y squared is x squared plus y squared plus xy plus yx. This is bounded away from zero, and that vanishes. Just because of the special structure of the matrices, the anti-commutator vanishes. And that's why such an interpolation is safe. We get a non-degenerate matrix along this path. So this works for free fermion systems, and I believe this observation was first made by Matt Hastings. Now I'll just take this property as a definition for a nice interacting system. And there are other examples that are not free fermions. For example, the AKLT state, spin chain in one dimension, has this property. So we'll give some generalization. A short-range entangled state will be defined using local data and local constraints. So the local data will be the reduced density matrices for all disks in the bulk, not touching the boundary of the big disk. So we have this big disk, and we have all disks of radius R. And for each such disk, we have the reduced density matrix rho sub d. These are the local data. Constraints are of two kinds. The first constraint is obvious. These reduced density matrices should be consistent on the intersection between any two disks. And the second condition is that each reduced density matrix is locally constructible. And that is a bit tricky. I will explain. So this property says that we can continuously interpolate between our system and a supplementary system and a trivial system. So the local constructibility means that we can start with a trivial system and produce our system along with something else which we won't use. So but this notion of local constructibility can be formalized using quantum circuits. Instead of saying that we can continuously interpolate between a trivial system and the state rho d with some supplementary system gamma d, we can say that we can obtain that state in a finite number of steps. And that won't be perfect, it won't be exact, but to a good precision we can obtain that state. So there will be a quantum circuit that starts with zeros, and again it's a base point problem. Now at each site on each atom we have a Hilbert space with a special state zero that makes a base point. And then we let those atoms interact with each other. The vertical direction is time. And so it continues, and this circuit has two important parameters. One is the interaction range. It should be geometrically local. It should only take qubits at most distance L apart. And the other parameter is the number of layers, or the depth of that circuit, d. And we say that rho d is L comma d constructible. If we start with the zero state on a slightly bigger disk, and we should add some cushion space of size d times L on both sides. So let me use this picture. This is the center of the disk, and the bottom, the initial state, will have size radius r plus dl. and the top will have radius R, and here we start with zero, and we run the circuit, and this line represents the causal region, meaning that if we make a measurement here, it will depend on the boundary conditions. If we make a measurement in the middle, it won't depend on the boundary condition. It will only depend on those zeros. And the idea is that we produce our state, rho d, tensor gamma d, on the top. And here there is some garbage. This is garbage we want to remove. So rho d is LD constructible if there is a circuit that produces rho d tensor gamma d. And one can add another parameter, epsilon, if it produces this state up to precision epsilon in the L1 norm. Gamma d is a supplementary state, because we cannot just produce rho d.
But there exists some gamma d?
Yeah, there is some gamma d.
Typically, gamma d is the time reversible copy of rho d?
Probably. In this example, yes, but I don't know if it's true in general. If there is a state gamma d and a circuit CD that has this property. And a nice thing about this definition is a patching lemma. If we can produce rho d prime, where d prime is a slightly bigger disk, and say d1 prime. And we can do the same for d2 prime. Let me use colors. So. Suppose we can do it for rho d1 prime and rho d2 prime, these blue disks that are slightly bigger than d1 and d2. Then we can do the same for the union of d1 and d2. And this picture is not very good. We want this to have non-trivial intersection. So. If we allow some extra cushion, then we can patch those small disks into arbitrary big disks. And it's really simple. It's like gluing pieces of paper. When we glue, we get some mess at the boundary and we want to cut. So, but that actually works. Now, the definition, this kind of definition, has a very nice consequence. Let's consider, let's first define spaces, B sub n and F sub n. This is for bosonic or spin systems. In d to the n, and that is for Fermi systems. And there should be some parallel theories for BN and FN. Let me focus on BN for the moment. I said systems actually short-range entangled states. And BN is the topological space of short-range entangled states. Then we have the following theorem. BN is homotopy equivalent to the loop space of BN plus 1. So BN, the sequence of spaces, forms an omega spectrum. And I don't, I cannot give a full proof, but let me show the idea, how we construct a map from BN to omega of BN plus 1, and how we construct the inverse map, which I inverse up to a homotopy. So, from BN to omega of BN plus 1, and this map alpha, it's a bit of cheating because this map will actually use not BN itself, but some bigger structure that involves this supplementary states gamma d and the corresponding circuits. But it turns out that if we fix a quantum state rho and consider those supplementary objects as a fiber over this space, this fiber is contractible, like in the case of Hamiltonians. So BN is the space of short-range entangled states together with supplementary data. Let me construct this map. So let's pick a point here. Let me call it rho. And there is another state gamma such that rho and gamma together can be produced by a circuit. And given this rho and gamma and the circuit, we'll construct a loop of states in one dimension higher. And let me do it for n equals 0. So we have rho and gamma, and the vertical direction will be the loop parameter. I'll call it time. It starts from 0 and ends with 1. Now, at t equal to 0, we'll have a trivial state, a bunch of zeros. At t equal to 1/2, we have alternating rho and gamma. And then we have zeros again. So first we apply our circuit to produce rho and gamma out of these two zeros. And and then we cancel this row with that gamma. So it's a process that starts with a trivial state, ends with a trivial state, and it goes through this intermediate phase. So it's a map going in that direction. There is a map going in the opposite direction.
Does this mean that the row and gamma of the ends cancel each other?
You mean at this? No, but... right. When I say states in DN, I mean that there's constructibility conditions only hold in disks inside. But near the boundary, the system, the state may be messy. We ignore the boundary. So it's okay if we produce a little bit of mess at the end. In this case, it's one rho and one gamma. By the way, there is a very nice physical analogy. Suppose we want to transport electric charge from here to the moon in 1 millisecond. It's faster than light. How do we do that? Create a chain of spacecrafts, and they will produce a pairs of electrons and positrons, and then there's annihilating and alternating pattern. Yeah. So, how do we construct that map? Now we have some state on a chain that involves evolves in time, and we want to produce a zero-dimensional quantum state out of that. So we first make a state on that chain that is very inhomogeneous. On the left, it looks like this evolving state at t equals 0. And at the right end, it looks like that state at t equals 1. And in the middle, it interpolates between the two. So basically, this state is kind of approximation to the diagonal. Let me just draw the diagonal. So it's a diagonal interpolation between these two. So, at the very left, it will have zeros because the initial state, by definition, of this loop, this is a loop starting at the base point, and the base point is a bunch of zeros. And here we also have zeros. So, this interpolated state will have zeros on both sides, and in the middle, it will be non-trivial. And although it's a state of a chain, we consider it as a zero-dimensional state. If we do that, we obtain that map. And now one can easily see that the composition of alpha followed by beta is homotopy equivalent to a trivial map. Because if we do that interpolation here, we get... I mean, if this evolving state is given by the left picture, then the interpolated state is 0, 0, and in the middle it will be something like rho, gamma, rho, and these two, rho and gamma, may be not fully formed. They are being formed from the two zeros, and same with this gamma and rho. They are not fully cancelled, going to be cancelled soon. But there is one rho in the middle that will stay. So if we cancel this row and gamma, and cancel those gamma in row, we'll get a single row. So it's half of the proof of that theorem. And it's already some interesting mathematical structure. So I can say a few more words about those spaces Bn and Fn, what I know at the moment about those spaces. I don't know, maybe it's already too late. Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, sure.
With the lowest Bn, B1 or B2, what's that?
Oh, B0 is B0 is CP infinity.
Okay.
Yeah, and B1 is KZ3.
So can I think of beta as basically creating a domain wall in a higher dimension space?
Yeah, sure.
Other questions? Thanks very much.